In June of 1924, 91 years ago, an extraordinary Englishman named George Mallory made his third attempt to ascend to the summit of Mount Everest. No one had ever done it before. At 29,000 feet, its pinnacle is the highest point on the face of this earth. To give you some perspective on what a trip that must have been, that's over 5 miles high from sea level. When the clouds clear in a couple of days and you see a little airplane jetting across the sky, it's about 30,000 feet up. That's the top of this mountain. George had gotten within about 1,000 feet 2 years earlier in 1922 when an avalanche took the lives of 7 of the Sherpas, the local helpers who were assisting him on the journey. But now in 1924, at the increasingly young sounding age of 37, he made his final attempt to be the first one to accomplish this. He took with him a pretty interesting guy named Andrew Irving, age 22. A whole group of them made it within just a few thousand feet, and they left that base camp behind, and those two were seen going past that last 800 feet up to the top. Evidence suggests that George Mallory and Andrew Irving were the first two men to stand on top of the world. And what a mountaintop experience that must have been. He'd been working towards that goal really his entire life. I was reading a book about him from his youth and just always trying to get to the top of whatever was in front of him. Truly, there must not have been a more astonishing, amazing moment than to finally be there. I'm talking about on top of the world. And the truth is, from the moment those two gentlemen stood on the top of the world, their future was set. It would take them about a month or two to get home, but by the time they got there, the news of their accomplishment would be all over London and all over the world. They would be celebrities, rich and famous for the rest of their lives. In fact, 2 years earlier, he didn't even make it to the top. And he was already world famous and had traveled to New York to do seminars on his accomplishments. He wrote a letter to his wife the day before that last ascent to his wife and his 3 daughters, and he said, "I'm doing this. I will finally accomplish my life goal, but when I get home, I'm never leaving again. I'll be there with you guys. We'll be set for life. I'll work at the university right up the street. When I get this done and I get home, the future will be bright and perfect." Only one problem. George Mallory and Andrew Irving never made it home. In fact, they never made it back down to where their crew was waiting at Base Camp 5. Somewhere along the way from the pinnacle back down, one of them took a wrong step. They were tethered together, and both of them fell to their deaths. In fact, only one of their bodies was found in 1999. It took 75 years, and they found one of their bodies. And as I was reading this, I recognized that all throughout his life, he always said that the climb down is the hardest. How ironic that the climb down is where he lost his life. And I was thinking about what it would be like to spend your whole life trying to get to something and now just ready to go home and enjoy it and then to fall to your death. Is it possible that in his last moments, George Mallory was realizing and thinking that the mountaintop experience only really matters if you make it home? Somewhere around the same time I was going through that book, I was also doing some Bible reading in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Can I ask you please to open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 10? This is a completely different type of scenario. We're not talking about two men who've devoted their lives to climbing to the top of Mount Everest. Instead, it's an entire nation, an entire group of millions of Israelites who have devoted hundreds of years to their mountaintop experience. That top of the world feeling, that one place where they'd never been, and that place was freedom. They wanted to experience a moment of freedom from Egyptian bondage. And finally, they did. Pardon me, I couldn't find any photos from the event. But their moment came, not on the top of a mountain, Their moment came when they stood on the mountainous terrain. After they had crossed the Red Sea and watched their adversaries wash away, they were finally free. There was not a moment like it in their entire history. If you have your Bibles open to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, look at verse 1. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. They made it. They experienced that which they had only dreamed to experience. And they celebrated. Do you remember Exodus 15? Most of Exodus 15 is probably like George and Andrew were doing on the mountaintop, just singing in jubilation that they had arrived. In Exodus 15, on the eastern bank of this particular sea, they sang the song of Moses. They praised the majesty of God. They were free. They were changed. And from that moment on, their future was set. You see it there in verses 3 and 4. God would give them food to eat. God would give them water to drink. Jesus would be their foundation. Yes, Jesus was there then, and He would lead them. All they had to do was make it home. They were free. Now, all they had to do was make it home. Home was Canaan, wasn't it? It was the land flowing with milk and honey. But keep reading in verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Most of them never made it home. I wonder if they thought that same thing. The mountaintop, joyous, most important and beautiful and significant moment in our lives of being baptized through the Red Sea and free only really matters if you make it home. It's the beginning, but you have to make it home. Verses 5 and 6 say, many of them did not make it home. Verse 6, the 1 Corinthian writer Paul is bringing all this up for us. And in verse 6 he says, these things happened as an example for us. So my question for you this morning is, how are we supposed to use this story? I hope you understand I'm not here to fill you in on Jeffrey Archer's Paths of Glory and the history of George Mallory. That's not our point. We're not even here to delve into all the significant and insignificant things that happened to Israel. Paul said there's a point here you must not miss, and I'll tell you what it is. How many people in this room this morning have been baptized into a relationship with Jesus? Your whole life, you waited for that moment. You were burdened with immaturity. You were burdened with the guilt of your own mistakes. All you wanted was freedom. All you wanted to do was come through and be on the other side and stand victorious. That's what he's describing in verse 2, a baptism. They were baptized in the Red Sea. There was water left, right, and a cloud over the top. We were baptized in water and raised up with Christ. And my question for you is, do you remember how that felt? Who remembers? Give me some nods or shakes. You remember that? Do you remember that feeling of this is what it's always been about? It's been about knowing that I am free. I'm on top of the world. I'm above the sin of my past. I've worked for it. I've pursued it. And God has led me here. And the truth is, when you come up out of that water, your future's set. You are fed by God. You are nourished by the Son of God. You stand on the rock that is Jesus the Christ. And one day, from that moment, you're going to get home. But can I just say it one more time? The mountaintop experience of being raised up from the waters of baptism and singing the song of deliverance only really matters if you make it home. This lesson this morning, I suppose, is for everyone, but I was thinking about our young Christians. Some of the youth among us who have recently experienced that. And in fact, we have some other members here older in years who've recently experienced that. You become a Christian. That's great. Celebrate that. Thank God for that every day. But now we got to get home. That's where the true accomplishment occurs, and that's where the true victory follows. Now, in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 10, verse 11, he says this, "Now, these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction upon whom the ends of the age have come." His point is, a lot of the Israelites got derailed along the way. They didn't get from deliverance home because they let some things lead them off the pathway. The point of 1 Corinthians 10 is, let's not have that happen to us. Let's look at their example. Let's study their story. Let's see that they had all this promise and they let this thing get in the way, and let's make sure that doesn't happen. That's what our study's about this morning. Making sure that we get home. I'm going home. And that means I'm going to stay on that pathway and not deviate, even in the face of things that try to draw me there. Now, before we look at the reasons why they were drawn away, I want you to focus on verse 13. I think you know this verse. 1 Corinthians 10, 13. I want this to be a positive, hopeful message. You can make it. We are not destined to fail. It is not pre-programmed that of all the people who enjoy that moment of baptism and freedom, most of them are going to get off the path and lose their souls, and only a few of us are going to heaven. I don't buy into that. I think we can all make it home. I think every Christian in this room, if you've experienced that moment, you can get where God wants you to go, and there will be a parade of celebration waiting when you get there. God has promised us that in this passage that we well know, verse 13. "No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man." In other words, the things that try to lead you off the pathway home have been happening for centuries. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. Somewhere on that mountainside, George or Andrew took a misstep, an improperly calculated step. They got off and they fell. What God is saying is, I'm not going to push you off the path, and I will not let the devil pull you off the path. If you were in our study a couple of weeks ago about the highway of holiness, there are no lions on the highway of holiness. The devil doesn't get to be on that path. That's our path. But he wants to pull us away, but he has to lead us away. God said, I won't let him pull you off. I'll make it where you can get home. I promise. I am faithful. You can make it. But you need to learn very clearly the four missteps that the Israelites took that cost many of them their lives and potentially their souls. So here's what we're going to do. It's found in four verses. Our entire structure of the middle portion of this lesson is found in verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. Four things that got in the way. And let's look at that, and then we'll be done this morning. While you're getting there and getting settled in and getting ready, let me just take a second and say thank you for being here today. This is about worshiping God. This is a celebration of who we are. And it's good to see so many members. We've got inclement weather out there. We have some visitors who've come. Met a fellow Jim just a couple days ago. Said he was kind of looking around for a church home. He's here. He's brought his three beautiful children, his wife. We're just here for this, you know. We're here to make sure we're free, and that freedom leads us to the benefit that God has been intending all along. Let's work on some of the warning signs we need to be looking out for. Would you look with me at verse 7? "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play." The first thing that led them from freedom to not getting home was they got pulled off the pathway by this thing called idolatry. Now, I'm not sure which Bible you have, what publisher, what translation, but if you're looking in verse 7, do you have sort of like all caps wording there, or maybe some italicized or indented? That's telling you, if you have that in verse 7, that what he's doing is he's quoting the Old Testament. So can you see if you can find where we need to go? I actually want to go back to the Old Testament and read a little bit about this idolatry business. So if I'm looking in verse 7 where it says the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play, my marginal note tells me we're headed back to Exodus chapter 32. So you're probably going to want to mark 1 Corinthians 10. We've got four verses we need to look at there. But let's just quickly run back and get a better idea what got in the way. And here's why I think this is beneficial. Idolatry, interesting word. Idolatry led some of them off the pathway. I think that typically today, if I ask you what is idolatry, you might say something like when you replace God with something else. When you move God over and you put something else in its place, that is idolatry, and that's going to cost you heaven, and you'd be right. And so we preach lessons about like watching too much television and stuff. so that it doesn't become your idol and replace God. But I think there's something different going on here almost entirely. Let me see if I can prove it to you. The story in Exodus chapter 32 is one that we know well. God has asked Moses to go up on top of the mountain, Mount Sinai, and God is going to give him the law, and he's going to lead the people. All right, you ready to go home? Let's go home. I'm going to give Moses the law. But how long did it take? The answer is too long for the Israelites. 40 days, right? Started ticking away. You know, a day would pass and another day, and they're thinking, well, I know God's going to get us home, but this sure is taking a long time. So they came up with an alternate plan. Focus on that term. A different plan. I'm in Exodus chapter 32. I'm looking at verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, come, make us a God who will go up before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now I'm going to ask you a question here. You're not probably going to agree with me initially, but I just want you to think about it. We can talk about it later. I don't think they built a golden calf to replace God. He was God. He was Yahweh. He was the Lord. It looks to me in verse 1, they're building a calf to replace whom? Who they want to replace? They want to replace Moses. We believe in God. We know the Lord will get us home. The problem is, he's chosen this path wherein we have to wait on Moses, and we're tired of that. We don't like waiting on Moses. So let's see if we can come up with sort of a substitute for him and see if that allows us to contact God more quickly. To give you some idea of why I'm convinced this is what's happening, look in verse 4. He took this from their hand and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a golden calf or a molten calf. And they said, this is your God, lowercase, your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh, the Lord. They haven't forgotten about the Lord. They just found a better way to get to him. We're replacing Moses and all that stuff with this that we made. This is our deliverer, not Moses. This is our deliverer, and it'll connect us to the Lord. How did God feel about that? Let me just say something. To replace God's plan is just as much idolatry as replacing God. Is that clear? To replace God's method, God's way, even though it takes patience and it takes discipline and it takes humility, to say, I'm going to come up with a different way to get there is just as much idolatry, because that's what it was called in 1 Corinthians 10. Idolatry. Verse 9. The Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people. Behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them. I will make of you a great nation. Now in the end, verse 28, Moses begged for mercy on behalf of the people. And in verse 28, there was some death. In the end, about 3,000 men died. God's anger was sort of appeased by the shedding of blood of probably the 3,000 men who were leading this charge. And so ultimately, idolatry got in the way. And here's what I want you to see. I'm going home. I am going home. And I don't want anything to get in the way. Now, if you came to me and said, all right, Chris, here's what I want you to do. I want you to forget about the Father, and I want you to serve something else instead. What would you say? We live in East Texas. You'd be like, you better get out of here. We're always going to serve God. We believe in God. Stop remembering Jesus and thinking about Him and serve some other son instead. We'd say, forget about it. Nobody in this room is at risk of replacing God. But I'll tell you what we see every day. We see the small step off the path of replacing God's plan. I don't want to give up on the Father or the Son or the Bible. I just found a different way to get to Him. We found a new way to worship. We found a different plan of salvation. We found something that the people want to hear. We found something that's working. We've come up with this beautiful molten calf, and it's good. You know what that is? It's idolatry. I used to drive by, when I preached at Dowell, and we would drive past a lot of different church buildings, and I would look at these huge buildings and all that was going on there, and I used to just sort of see these denominations who weren't teaching the Bible. But now when I drive by these places, I see molten calves in their parking lot, because that's what it is. It's a step off of the way home to build some shorter route, some shortcut, some alternate path. So what do we need to do? It's pretty simple. We need to hang on really, really tightly to this book. It's not just about God, it's about God's way and God's plan. We want to worship just like the Bible teaches. We want to become Christians just the way the Bible teaches. You will be tempted and sold the idea of easier ways. One of our shepherds stood up before us a few minutes ago and emphasized the need to be faithful to worship services, even when we're singing. We've rebranded it special service to get you more excited. You can go find a church where you'll never hear that. You can go find a way where faithfulness to worship and devotion to God's people is purely optional. I'm here to tell you that that, my friends, is idolatry. Because it's finding a way to God that is not of God, that's not from God. So I'm going home. And that means God's way all the time. Let's go back to our text. He said, all right, we lost some. Now, they didn't lose all. You notice only 3,000 men died. And so now it's like, okay, we've gotten the idolatry thing out of the way. We need to do this God's way. No other way. Now, everybody should have made it home, but they didn't. More of them were tempted and stepped off the pathway, but it was something different. Go back to 1 Corinthians 10. Verse 7 says, do not become idolaters. Verse 8 says, nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 people fell in one day. Immorality. I could preach the rest of the morning reminding us of this. Immorality. Lustful thinking. Pornographic viewing. Adulterous and fornication behavior. It's not some roadblock on the path that hopefully you'll stop for a little while, move it away, and move through. It is a stepping off of the path. It is leaving the way home, trying some very sensitive and unproven ground. And can I just tell you that men and women who have temporarily stepped off the pathway of God to indulge their lust, can I just tell you that some of those bodies have never been found? You lose your way home through this. Did it happen to the Israelites? You know that it did. Go back with me to the book of Numbers this time. This story comes from Numbers chapter 25. I'm going home. I didn't come up out of that water and remember that image with perfect clarity and teach others that they can get to the top of the mountain too, just so I can let some internet web page cost me my soul. I'm not going that way. I'm going home. Numbers 25 shows what happened to them. In Numbers chapter 25, please, I'm talking about verse 1. When Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to sacrifice to their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So you had some idolatry happening here, but that's not what's being pointed out. Verse 6 is what's being pointed out. Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman, in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, went after the man of Israel into the tent, pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body, so the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. What's going on here? God's law said you cannot marry foreign women. I forbid you, in terms of morality, to marry women who are not of the Israelite group. They acted immorally. They violated God's moral code, and to try to help from keeping everybody to go down, this priest kills, and in verse 9, those who died by the plague were 24,000. So 23,000 died in one day, 1 Corinthians 10, and ultimately the total was 24,000. I imagine they didn't recognize that when it was happening. We're still going home. We are still going to make it to Canaan. We're still going to have milk and honey. But along the way, I'm just going to pick up this wife that maybe God will understand. God considered that a stepping off of the path, and they lost their lives. And so listen, I know we live in a culture where this might be the difficult, most difficult point of all four, where immoral behavior is sold as normal behavior. In fact, to be moral is to be abnormal in our time. To be pure, to monitor your thoughts and who you interact with and what you do and who you join yourself to, and to make yourself be disciplined and pure is a narrow road. The pathway home is not very wide. The pathway home is narrow. It's disciplined. It takes focus. But here's what I want to do. I want to call immorality what it is. Immoral thinking, viewing, and behaving is not just me slowing down on the path and taking a break. You guys understand that? It is me stepping off the path onto unproven, shaky, uncertain ground, hoping that it will stay there until I'm ready to step back on the highway of holiness. Can I just say, and I'll let you agree with me if you'd like, I don't need that in my life. I don't need it. I'm going home. Some of them stepped off the path to immorality. That is not for the Christian. We're going home. Here's a third thing. Go back to the text. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he talked about replacing God's plan. So we need to be great Bible students and make sure we don't do that. And he talked about immorality as well. And now he goes on to something else. Third point here back in our text, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 9. Nor, he says, let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. The word I put up behind me is doubting God, and I think you'll see that in the story in a moment. You would think that now that they've recognized that we can't replace God's plan, we'll never get home that way, and now that they've recognized that God's really serious about His morality instruction, you would hope that everybody else made it home. But they didn't. Some of them started to doubt that God's plan was best. Let me show this to you. Go back with me to the book of Numbers again. This time we need to back up just a little bit from our previous read. I'm asking you to be in Numbers chapter 21. It wasn't easy. The trip down Mount Everest wasn't easy. The traversing to the land of Canaan wasn't easy. Coming up out of the waters of baptism and serving God until Jesus comes back with a trumpet sound is not easy. So what are you going to do when it gets hard? And it gets hard. And we've all experienced that. But let me tell you the route that the Israelites took. I'm in Numbers chapter 21, verse 3. The Lord heard the voice of Israel, delivered up the Canaanites. Then they utterly destroyed them in their city. So I just read that to show that God's protecting them, taking care of them. Then they set out from Mount Or by the way of the Red Sea. This is Numbers 21:4. To go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. They spoke against God. Can you imagine this for just a moment? They spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? I mean, just sit on that a second. They said that to God. For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. I can't believe they said that. But it got hard, and they got hungry. And instead of fighting for it, they're doubting whether God's way was really the right way at all. They're effectively saying, look, I know God, you want to take us to this beautiful place. We've not even seen it yet. We're just trusting you that it's gorgeous. So we're thinking maybe this was too hard. Maybe we should have stayed in Egypt. And in fact, maybe we should just go back. At least in Egypt, we knew when our meals were coming and we knew what they were. I think about this story a lot. I wish I could tell you that no Christian has ever done this. Not a single brother or sister in Christ. Sure, they felt that little bit of doubt, that little weakness in faith they had to work on, but there's never been a brother or sister who said, this is too hard. I think I'd rather just go back to my old life. At least I got to do what I wanted to do. At least I knew what was there for me, and I was able to indulge in it. I'm doubting whether God's way is even the right way. That's what they were doing. And it happens even today. And so here's what God did about that. So the people, verse 6, the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many of the people died. So the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us. And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent. You'll recognize this story, I'm sure. Make a fiery serpent. Set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he will live. Moses made a bronze serpent, verse 9, set it on a standard. It came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked to the bronze serpent, he lived. Now, I can't fill in details for you on this, but here's how I imagine that it happened. The people are sick and tired, and they're wondering if God's way is best. So they're saying, I think we'd like to go home to Egypt. So God says, okay, first thing I'm going to do is take my blessings away from you. Boom. You've been bitten by a deadly snake. Now, over there is Egypt, a couple hundred miles that way. Over there is a bronze serpent. Choice is yours. If you want to go that way, you can try to make it. You're probably not going to make it. But even if you do make it, what do you think the Egyptians are going to do when you get back? Think they're going to hug you and give you their medicine? If you do, you go right on ahead. Take your disease and go. Or you can go this way. You can look upon the serpent. I can cleanse you and we can keep moving forward. He made them make a choice. Some of them didn't get to make the choice, though. They died. They didn't get to choose it. The rest of them chose life. Now, I recognize this story not from Numbers 21, but from where? Do you remember in the Gospels? Isn't it a John 3:16 area? God so loved the world, He gave His only begotten Son. But do you remember John 3:14 and 15? Like the bronze serpent that was set up on a standard, so the Son of God was lifted up. So that when the path gets hard, and we start doubting whether it's worth it, and we start looking back at the old life in the easy way, we first recognize that we are diseased with sin, and you've got two choices. You can go back towards the world and die, or you can look to Jesus and live. I'm going home. I'm not going back. We left that life on purpose. We left that life for purpose. We left that life because we believe in Jesus. We will not always understand what God is doing. If you have a full understanding of what God is doing, you can preach tonight. We're not going to get that. And sometimes that translates into fear and doubt. But I'm not going back to death. I would just encourage, if there's somebody here who's doubting whether this is worth taking the next step, look to Jesus. Look to the bronze serpent on the standard. Look to the one who gave His life. Because you only get two choices. Look to Him and live, or go back and die, and there's no other choice. Some of them lost their way. Some of us have lost our way. I'm going home. One more thing and then we're done. Go back to our text. I have to say, it kind of feels like these four things are ascending in gravity. You know, you start with this idea of idolatry and then you get to this idea of immorality, and now you're sort of doubting the whole plan. And then it almost finishes a little bit anticlimactic, I guess. Because lastly, in 1 Corinthians 10, as we wind this down, he says, "Nor grumble or complain, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer." It's like he's building these momentous mistakes, and then his last one kind of seems like a downer. Oh, by the way, you complained all the time. Why would he finish with this one? I want to suggest something to you this morning. That for godly, committed, faithful Christians, this last thing claims more souls than the other three combined. Because it's not just one moment where you decide to act immorally and you don't find your way back, or one moment when you decide to leave the faith and try some new way to God. It's this ongoing, all the time, week after week, discontentment and complaining about what God has not done for you, or what the brethren haven't done for you, or what you don't like, or what's not right. That's what's interesting about his finale. I could give you any number of places. You guys remember Exodus 15. Go back to Exodus 15 a moment. What happened in that chapter? We call it the Song of Moses, Exodus 15. They've come up out of the water. They're at the top of Mount Everest. They're celebrating their accomplishment. It's Exodus 15. It's celebration time. Can I just ask you, chapter-wise, have you gotten there yet? How many chapters after Exodus 15 did the Israelites start complaining? How many? Exodus chapter 15, verse 24. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" It's been hours, not even like a day has passed, and already it's just not what I thought it was going to be. I'm not going to give up. And notice, this isn't like our last one. I'm not going to give up and go back to Egypt. I'm not going to find some new plan. I'm just not going to be real happy about this. And I'm going to constantly talk about it and talk about God and talk about Moses or an eldership or a preacher or the person sitting in a pew behind me and what's just not right. I'm still going to heaven. You're still going to heaven. We're still in this. We're still looking at Jesus. But I just can't feel great about it. Can I just go ahead and drop a bomb on you real quick? You're not going home. Home is a place for optimists. Home is a place for people who have a positive outlook, a hopeful attitude. Home is not for grumblers. They grumbled in chapter 15, chapter 16, chapter 17, chapter 20, and I could go on and on and on. And ultimately, if we had more time, we would look at Numbers 11 and Numbers 16. In Numbers 11, God had kind of had it, you know? In Numbers 11, they're grumbling about food again. He said, you know what? Go out there and eat all the quail you want, and you will choke on it. And they did. They actually choked on it, and a lot of them died. And he talked about their greediness. In Numbers chapter 16, they were complaining and arguing about God's choice and who God chose for this and why he didn't choose me. And God ended some more lives. When you pick up the notes in the back, if you want to take a look at that, Numbers 11, God had had it with the grumbling. Numbers 16. I would say that more people of the Israelites never made it home because of just a general demeanor of discontent than all of the immoral marriages, idolatrous behavior, and going back to Egypt combined. Where am I going? I'm going home. Doesn't mean we're going to like everything. Doesn't mean everything's going to be just how we want it to be, but I'm going home. I'm not going to complain or grumble because I believe that heaven's not for everybody. I believe heaven is for people who can be happy and are okay with that. People who can look over things that they don't like because they're patient about it and they're going to see it get better and they want to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. Heaven is a place for celebration. It's a place for people who have the right attitude, and I want to get there, so I need to have the right attitude today. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and let's close this. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, pardon me, and let's close. I'm going home. That means looking at the bright side of who we are, focusing on what is good, and continuing to celebrate the will of God. Discontentment is just as dangerous a step off the pathway as anything else. Let me finish with this. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. I just want you to recognize that while everything behind me still represents a danger, we're facing these kinds of things. We can make it. Forget I'm going home. We're going home. Everybody in this room, let's get home. Let's not void that beautiful baptism that you enjoyed. And I would just say as we close, if you've not yet come through that water and you've not yet been raised up, baptized through water into a relationship with Jesus, the top of the mountain will take your breath away. It is beautiful. It is worth every ounce of energy you put into climbing to the top, becoming a Christian, baptized through that water, and the first breath you take when you come up out of that water will be the first breath you've ever taken. If you haven't done that, you must. For those of us who have, let's make that mean something. Let's keep going. Let's get home. 1 Corinthians 10, 13, we can do this. We can do it this way. Verse 12 first. Three things and we're done. Really quick observations. Three things that will help us. Verse 12. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Number one, we need to be humble about this. This is not a sermon for the other guy. You know what I mean? This is not about what other people need to realize. I need to be humble, verse 12, enough to know that when I think I got this, I'm getting really close to leaving the pathway. I need to be humble, recognize that I need to be careful. That's verse 12. Verse 13, I need to trust that God can help me. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it. We're going home. God said, I'm going to help you. I'm humble about it. Verse 12, God is helping me. In verse 14, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. We've got to make some choices. It's not just about humility and God's power. We're the ones walking this thing. I'm the one walking this thing. I have to flee the foreign pathways. I have to make sure that I'm worshiping God's way with God's heart, morally, and with my eyes set on Jesus. I can do it, but it's my choice. Same is true for you this morning. If there's somebody here who stepped off that pathway, but you're still here today, God bless you for His patience. This is a moment of restoration for you, of realization of what to do next. And for those who are on the highway of holiness, live it, love it, pursue it with great hope for what's coming. Tonight we're going to talk about that, the hope of what's coming. If we can encourage you, come forward now as we stand and sing.